encampment dismantled. Law enforcement and riot gear bring an end to a week-long protest at UCLA. Using flashbangs and zip ties, protesters detained one by one. After a nine-hour-long standoff, more than 200 arrested.
Free Palestine!
If I'm free, then what does that mean if my brothers and sisters in Palestine aren't free?
They're just free Palestine. That's why we're all here. And this is an attack on democratic rights. This is outrageous.
Fox 11 showing Thursday's removal of a pro-Palestinian encampment at UCLA, where more than 200 people were arrested just days after a violent attack by counter-protesters that took police hours to respond to. Onlookers watched as a large group of counter-protesters arrived in masks Tuesday night with pepper spray. They tore down the encampment, or tried to, and assaulted protesters. In the aftermath, UCLA says it plans to change the way it handles campus security. The administration created a new position to oversee its police chief, John Thomas. He is facing calls to resign for not doing enough to prevent the mob from attacking pro-Palestinian demonstrators. We're going to talk about this now with Teresa Watanabe, who covers higher education for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hi there.
All right. So UCLA is creating a new Office of Campus Safety and is appointing the former Sacramento Police Chief, Rick Brazil. Tell us more about him and what he will be doing.
Yes, Rick Brazil is a highly experienced law enforcement and public safety professional. He was a former police chief for the city of Sacramento. He has also been a consultant to review police actions in many high-profile cases across the country, including Ferguson, including the Uvalde, Texas elementary school shooting. And so UCLA Chancellor Gene Block has tapped him to lead a new Office of Campus Safety, where he will directly oversee the police department and the Office of Emergency Management, reporting directly to Gene Block, and will have this as his sole focus.
All right. And there have been calls from the governor on down for an investigation into what happened last week when it took police about 3 hours to move in when there were really violent clashes happening. Have you been able to piece together the chain of events, why the police didn't move in sooner?
Yes. Yeah, so three sources last week told me that Chief Thomas had, failed in the ability to carry out the campus leadership directive to keep the campus safe, that he had failed to provide a written plan for how he was going to deal with any scenarios, including violence, that he had failed to secure additional outside law enforcement, even though the campus gave him the green light to spend whatever it took. So Chief Thomas, in responding to that, told me that that was not true and that what had actually happened was that he was given the green light to hire external law enforcement, and he did contact the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, as well as the LA County Sheriff's Department. But the LAPD told him that there was some payment issue that would delay payment between the city of Los Angeles and the state of California. And therefore, Thomas said he was not able to secure that law enforcement assistance by the time the mob attack occurred on that Tuesday. And he also said that he was barred from bringing in police until later because of a directive to try to handle the situation with only private security. And of course, private security doesn't have the authority to arrest. He said that he had done everything he could, that when he arrived at the campus on Tuesday, there were about 19 officers from the LAPD, from mutual aid, and from the campus there, but the force was too small to intervene, and that's why they had to stand there until greater numbers were assembled and mobilized to step in and quell the violence.
Right. And so what do the administrators say about that? Because they're saying that, look, he had the authority to call in the police, right? And he didn't. And he was supposed to provide a written plan and he didn't. And this just became chaos under his lack of direction.
Yeah, you know, right now there are so many people pointing fingers at other people in terms of who really was responsible. So while Chief Thomas is saying that he tried, but the LAPD told him there was a payment issue, there were top LAPD leaders who have told the Times that it was Thomas whose lack of coordination, lack of communication, prevented them from being able to mobilize quickly enough. And then you also have the UC Police Officers Union pointing the finger at administration, saying they were the ones who didn't sufficiently give strategic direction, and therefore the fault lay on, the blame should be placed on them. So right now there is a few inquiries going on. UCLA Chancellor Gene Block has called for his own internal review, and the University of California president, Michael V. Drake, also has launched an external investigation into exactly what happened and where the security lapses occurred.
And there have been calls for Chancellor Block to step down, but he's stepping down anyway, right, at the end of the school year?
Chancellor Block, yeah, he had already announced that he would be retiring. I believe his retirement date, well, not retirement. He's stepping aside as chancellor, although he will remain as faculty at the campus. Mm-hmm. And that is supposed to be July 31.
Meanwhile, have any of the counter-demonstrators, the pro-Israel demonstrators who engaged in the violence, has anyone been arrested?
We have not heard of any arrests. We haven't even heard of anyone who has been definitively identified. And I know that there are efforts going on all over to try to identify them through videos and crowdsourcing information. So we'll see how that plays out.
But 200 or so pro-Palestinian demonstrators were arrested, correct?
Yes, there were arrests. Many of them have been released, and we are still trying to pin down information on what the status is of all of those arrests.
And has the university said anything about, I know that there were more arrests actually today, over whether they will allow more protesting, or will they just, crack down on any attempts to organize going forward?
Oh, no, they won't crack down on attempts to organize, because they, you know, that is a First Amendment right. And as a public university, they are held to allowing the First Amendment right of assembly and right of free speech and all of that. It's still not clear exactly who was arrested this morning. We were told by the campus that 44 people were arrested. Initially, we were told that at least some of them were people who are not affiliated with the university, and non-affiliates are barred from entering the campus between midnight and 6 a.m. So we initially were told that some of that was due to alleged violation of those curfew rules. But we also know, I was told by students, that some of those who were arrested were students who were protesting. So if they were arrested for protesting, it would probably be because they were, violating some campus rule, allegedly violating some campus rule. I know there have been reports about some graffiti and defacing of UCLA buildings. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really know exactly who was arrested and why.
Okay. Teresa Watanabe, education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
Pro-Palestinian students at UCLA and other universities across California are demanding their schools divest from Israel. But here in California, divestment may not be legally achievable because of a little-known civil rights law that Governor Jerry Brown signed back in 2016. Joining me to talk about this is Jessica Levinson, our legal and professor at Loyola Law School. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, this law is called AB 2844. It's very catchy. That's the name of the assembly bill it's based on. What exactly does it do?
Well, although maybe more colloquially known as the anti-BDS piece of legislation, although I'm not sure it's actually as broad as we might think it is. So it basically says if you submit a bid or proposal to get a state contract that's a big contract that's worth more than $100,000, then you have to certify that you're not going to discriminate against foreign nations, and it explicitly calls out Israel. Now, the reason I think that the law is actually slightly more confined than it might sound on our original description is that it doesn't say to contractors, you can't boycott Israel. What it says is that you can't do so in a way that would violate existing state laws when it comes to discrimination. So the UNRU Act, for instance, it talks about saying you can't discriminate in a way that violates people's civil rights, that violates rights when it comes to housing or employment, because if you do, you don't get your state contract.
And so that includes divestment then. As you mentioned, it's called colloquially the anti-BDS bill, which stands for Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions. So it would also apply to divesting?
So I think that's actually the question in terms of in application, because if you look at the actual language, it says you have to certify that if you're asking the state for a contract, you have to certify that you're not going to violate any state laws when it comes to discrimination, again, public accommodations laws, employment laws, housing laws. And then there's this addition, and don't discriminate if you're targeting a foreign nation and specifically Israel. So I think the question is whether certain actions related to the BDS movement would amount to discrimination under the legislation. And frankly, I just think we haven't stress tested that much.
But they might be at risk, these universities that are public, they might be at risk of losing state funding.
That's right. I mean, that is the argument here, which is that if they did, in fact, follow through on the protesters' demands, for instance, to divest, that would you then be violating this law? And if you are, then you have a choice. You can either cease your actions, or you can give up your contract. And for a lot of these local universities, public universities, obviously, there is no ability to say, well, we can just live without the state funding.
So critics say that boycotting is really a constitutional right, right? That it is their way of expressing their First Amendment rights, in effect, it's speech. So how would courts look at this?
This is such a good question. And we have the best guidance, the kind of latest guidance, I think, from the Eighth Circuit, actually, a case that came out of Arizona. And the reason I'm saying the Eighth Circuit and not the Supreme Court is that the Supreme Court was asked to take that case, and they said, no, actually, we're not going to, which, as you know, just lets the lower court ruling stand. And in that Eighth Circuit ruling, they said boycotts are not expressive enough to merit First Amendment protection, but specifically that the First Amendment would protect the speech and association that's made in support of a boycott, but it stops short of protecting you when it comes to purchasing decisions involved in a boycott. I know that sounds so in the weeds, but if we want to think about it, it's the difference between expressive activities and commercial transactions.
But this makes me think of Citizens United, because in that case, didn't the Supreme Court say that money equals speech in the case of corporations and campaign finance, that to limit it would be limiting their First Amendment rights?
Yes. And I mean, this is such a good, like, how do these different types of law play together? And I'd say a couple of things, but I think the most important is that Citizens United is really, as you said, about campaign finance. It's about spending in politics, and it's about corporations being able to say, we want you to vote for this particular candidate and not for that particular candidate. Whereas there's an entirely different First Amendment analysis when it comes to, can the state put strings attached to money that it gives you? And they're, I mean, I don't know how to say this other than they are just totally different days in my First Amendment class. In one case, you're not saying to the state, can I have money? I promise not to do something in return for that money. And in one case, you're exercising pure political speech.
Well, I guess the protesters would say this is pure political speech.
I think they would. And that's where we have that, I think, importance on the fact that they might say it's exercising pure political speech. But what the Eighth Circuit is telling us is go ahead and exercise that speech, but then don't act on it when it comes to purchasing decisions, number one. And then number two, we just are much less worried about saying you can't engage in this activity if there are strings attached, meaning if there's money at the end of it, because we think you have a choice. If you want to engage in that behavior, then you give up the money.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's not a challenge to your basic rights. It's just whether or not you want to accept the money in exchange for our rules.
And those who, exactly. And those are who are proponents of the legislation, I think, would say, look, it doesn't do that much more than just add to our existing discrimination laws. Those who are against the legislation would say, well, really, actually, it is just targeting BDS, and that is a protected type of expression.
Jessica Levinson is our legal here on Press Play. She joins us most Mondays. She's also a professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, remember the Hollywood writers and actors strikes? Ugh, well, another union is now in negotiations. We'll talk about whether there could be another strike here and why Hollywood production has really not gotten back to where it was post-strike. And a little later, we'll have a conversation with singer Joan Baez. So stick with us. Those stories are coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Everyone was relieved when the Hollywood strikes ended in November last year. But more than 6 months later, production is still not back to normal, though it's better now than it was at the beginning of this year. Film LA, the office that tracks production and issues permits, says compared to last year, overall production is down 9%. TV is the main problem. TV show production is down 16%. There are several reasons. Shows are shooting out of state for tax reasons. Some shows have been canceled, and there's overall less money for new shows. And on top of that, there's the threat of another strike, this time with IATSE. That's the union that represents behind-the-scenes workers like cinematographers, editors, hair and makeup, costume grips, gaffers. IATSE is asking for better pay, better health and retirement benefits, and of course, better AI protections. We're going to talk about this now with an IATSE member, Chris Call. He's been a prop master for 30 years, and he lost months of work during last year's strikes. He's watching closely now as his union negotiates. Chris, welcome back to Press Play.
Thanks so much, Madeline. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. Well, we had you last August on to talk about how these strikes were affecting you. They were not your union strikes, but they still affected you. And remind us what you went through during that time.
The hardest part about going through all that was never knowing when it was going to be over. When I talked to you in August, we all thought that September was going to come. The contracts were going to get negotiated. We were all going to go back to work. What happened during the pandemic, it just kept going on and the strikes kept lasting longer. And then when they were ratified for SAG and WGA, we thought that was it. It was all coming back. But lo and behold, here we are and things are still not happening. And for me, I finished my last show February 17th of 2023. And what a lot of people don't understand is that, again, a lot of work started drying up before the strikes even happened, before the negotiations even happened, because there was a constriction happening in the industry. And so a lot of things that would normally have started up just didn't start up. So As people's shows were ending, nothing was happening. So a lot of people have been out of work since the beginning of 2023 and are still out of work. I am grateful and blessed to have gotten on one of the very few shows that have started up in the new year. So I am back to work, but it was 13 months for me being out of work.
Wow.
And yeah, it was very scary.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you're on an NBC show. So that's regular hours, regular pay. And other people that you know, though, colleagues, have not had that opportunity, and what are they doing?
Well, absolutely. A lot of my colleagues are in very dire straits. I mean, I can't even emphasize enough how bad it is out there for people. You know, we're very stoic people, the below the line crew. You know, we're used to adversity and change, but this is taking people out that I can't even describe to the level of people who've lost their homes. They've been evicted. They've living in their cars. They've had their cars repossessed. They've had to move back home, or they've just had to change careers or retire early, which a lot of what has been happening as well. And again, here we are still not knowing when it's going to be over.
So I guess it is trending upwards from the beginning of the year. Are you noticing that? Is it getting a little bit better?
It is getting a little bit better. What I'm finding is that shows that were greenlit before or that are, had a second season already on the books, ready to go, those shows have come back. But again, to me, it seems like it's about 30% of what it was. And again, having said that, we all know that in 2022, we are in a boon. Okay, there was so much production because of all of the streamers, which they've all pulled back on. So that makes it seem a lot less busy than it was as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A lot of the workers who came up during that boon in 2022, a lot of the newer people, those are the people who have gone off and found other jobs and other, you know, careers, because there's just not enough to sustain. But a lot of my colleagues that have been in the business their whole careers and know nothing else but the film industry have not been able to find work. I mean, we're talking about top of the line people.
Wow, that is really sad. And so, and there isn't a strike fund now. There isn't extra pandemic aid as there was in years past. So it's, and like, it's really, really hard for people, I can imagine, to make ends meet. As you say, they're losing homes, they're living in their cars, etc.
Yeah, and but, unemployment has run out for them a long time ago, and now people are losing their health coverage as well.
Oh, wow. So what does this mean for the contract negotiations with IATSE?
Well, again, I mean, let's put it this way. Nobody wants another strike, okay? But at the same time, sitting back and watching SAG and the WGA fight for and get a lot of what they need, not just want, but need in this economy that we live in now, you know, we're in for the fight. I mean, if that's what it's going to take, you know, I mean, again, we're hunkering down. We're trying to make the best of it. But, you know, it's our turn now. And we can't afford a 3% increase in wages in an economy where 7% inflation and higher is happening. So as much as we don't want to have another strike, and it looks like we might be able to avert a strike. I mean, some of the early negotiations have been going very well. And IA has been doing a great job fighting for us on a local level. You know, we're ready. We're going to do what it takes to get the what we need, because otherwise we can't afford to stay in this business.
So they're offering a 3% wage increase?
That's what it's been in the past. I don't know what the current negotiation is, but the last time we did a contract, and for many cycles before that, it's always been around 3%, which has not been great for us in any of those negotiations, but it was something. And we lose more and more every negotiation. And I think this time out, everybody realizes that we have to fight for more, because things aren't getting better. They're tightening across the board. And whatever film workers are left, we're going to need to have a decent contract to be able to provide the services that the studios need. And I think they understand that.
Do you think that, let's say, if a strike is called, and as you say, the talks are going pretty well from what you understand. So that is definitely not a foregone conclusion that you'll walk. But if you do, do you think the other unions would support you?
Wow. I sure would like to think so, Madeline, because we were there for them. And so I could only hope that we can have the solidarity of the unions that we stood in line with as well.
Meanwhile, production is leaving the state for various reasons. Tax incentives, I guess, is the main reason. California has some production incentives, I think a 20 or 30% tax credit for movies and TV shows. So I'm wondering if you consider leaving the state to, you know, work in places like Atlanta or other places where there does seem to be more production.
I actually started my film career in a secondary market, and came to Los Angeles. I love California. I love LA. And I mean, this is the center of film production for over 100 years. And they're building stages everywhere in this town. So they must have a plan of some sort. I do think that we need to increase our incentives or do whatever we need to, because it's true. A lot of films and TV shows are leaving Los Angeles again. We've had this happen before, and we've fought and brought them back. But the incentives for productions to shoot across the country and other places and across the world are very strong right now, because they have crews that are just as seasoned as a lot of us in LA now. So you're not losing that quality of crews like you were before. And it's a large part of the economy of LA. So
yeah,
it's worth it.
Well, okay. Thank you very much for coming back on the show, and best of luck to you. And I hope production picks up.
Absolutely, man. Thank you.
Chris Call has been a prop master for 30 years. Coming up, Joan Baez is here to talk about her new book of poetry, Poems from the 90s, when she realized something had happened to her as a child.
So, it took me till I was 50 to even admit there was something down there that was giving me phobias and insomnia and all the things, you know, that are listed in the poetry book.
A conversation with Joan Baez next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
River of Jordan is muddy and cold. Well, it chills the body, but not the soul.
That's All My Trials, sung by the musician and activist Joan Baez, an icon of the 1960s American folk movement. She was also a big part of the civil rights movement.
We are not afraid today.
That's Joan at the March on Washington in 1963. She also demonstrated with Cesar Chavez in California, was active in the protests against the Vietnam War, and she was, of course, at Woodstock in 1969.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night. Alive as you and me.
Joan Baez has put out more than 30 albums over her 6-decade-long career. She's inspired many artists, including the Beatles and, more recently, Lana Del Rey. Joan Baez retired from touring back in 2019 and now has turned to painting, drawing, and publishing books. She's out now with a new collection of poems. It's called When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance. She wrote the poems in the 1990s when she was processing child abuse she had newly remembered. And a warning here, we will be talking about that period of her life. So if you want to listen later, you can find this conversation on our podcast. Joan Baez, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me. And the years you're talking about are not nearly as juicy as one might think.
They seem very juicy. And they have been immortalized in our collective imagination. And so how do you feel about that, being part of our collective imagination as Americans?
Well, I hope that whatever part of your brain I'm taking up, it has a positive effect just for the work I've done and the songs I've sung for such a long time.
Yeah. And that incredible soprano voice of yours, there's nothing like it. So do you miss singing?
I don't miss concerts. No, I miss singing because that soprano voice doesn't exist anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. Anybody gets older, the voice starts to lower, and mine got lower and lower. And now I don't want to do anything except use this raspy little sort of jazz sounding voice periodically. But I don't miss the concerts. No.
No, they were such a huge part of your life. And I think I saw an interview once where you said, or read an interview once where you said that you felt more comfortable in front of thousands of people performing than maybe in more intimate settings.
Yeah, that's true. I'm able to deal with more intimate settings now. I don't mean a partner, but I mean friends that were hard for me to make back then. I have lots of very good friends now, and I think that's something I couldn't have had years ago, but I do have now, and I'm grateful for it.
Right. So you have intimate friendships, and you also have a son and a granddaughter. Yeah. Are you close with both of them?
I am indeed. I'm very close with both of them.
I want to talk about the title of the book. It's called When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance, where you're writing about your mother. And it's the name of one of the poems in the book. Can you talk about this poem? It's a fairly lengthy poem compared to some of the other ones. And it's quite descriptive of your mother as a young woman.
Yeah. You know, my mom loved classical music. And when I was very young, she played Jussi Björling, who's a Swedish tenor. And I learned to love that voice really above all other operatic voices. But Mom just adored it. And in my mind, I started putting these things together. Mom's feelings about him, what the music had meant in my life. And it got down to our initials were the same. I mean, it got crazy. Mm-hmm. But it's a story of my mom meeting Björling at this imaginary dance. And my hand kind of took off writing this thing. So, you know, it's a fantasy, but it's coming out of real life feelings of my mom. And, you know, and we imagine in the poem that the feelings were reciprocal.
So she had never met Jussi Björling.
No, she hadn't. She took me to see a concert one night, but, you know, he was a known alcoholic and it said he had canceled. So we figure, you know, he was probably out on a binge somewhere. But I was so sad we missed that, but so pleased that my mother had cared enough to try to get me there.
I love it because it's a whole fantasy of her meeting him and they're dancing and they kiss. And you describe her as she's the dark girl. She's a gypsy and a vamp, a foster child. She's a flower.
Yeah. She was kind of in that situation, she was a wallflower. But in most situations, she was a lovely flower, my mom.
And what about your dad? What was he like?
My dad was, and that comes out in a lot of poetry too. He was a teacher, a professor, researcher, and he had trouble relating to any of the females in the house. And there were four of us and only one of him. So when he would talk about the things that he loved, we didn't relate at all. And often I remember taking my dad one time to one of those places where you paint the pottery and then they fire it for you. And there are all these colors. And I said, come on, Dad, you can do this. And so we were painting and he had this, he didn't like what was coming out. It wasn't scientific. It wasn't anything he couldn't measure. And he was making this great dish. I wish I still had it. With all these colors, he kept saying, this is awful. I said, no, Pop, this is art. This is great. You know, and trying to cross those bridges to each other was always a challenge.
Right. And he was a brilliant scientist, right? And he invented an X-ray technology used in the medical world. And you traveled a lot as a family as he was getting different positions and ended up, he was at MIT for a while.
Yes, he was. He was at MIT. He was also a professor at the Baghdad University in Iraq. You know, we were all these places with him. The family went with him for the good and for the bad. We were many, many places in the world.
So you have been public about a recovered memory that you had in midlife of him and of his abuse. And I'm wondering if you want to talk about that at all. You don't have to, if you don't want to.
Oh, sure. It was, you know, it wasn't just my dad. It was a number of people. We don't have to go into details, but what any abuse can do to a child's mind, I think is worth people thinking about. It doesn't have to be radical. It's the being abused or being abandoned, how many years it takes to number one, appreciate that that's what happened, and number two, deal with it. So it took me till I was 50 to even admit there was something down there that was giving me phobias and insomnia, and all the things, you know, that are listed in the poetry book. Oh, why was that all happening? And then I thought, okay, it's down in there somewhere. Let me see if I can go down, find it and deal with it, which is what I did. And it took years. And during those years of that recovery work is when all the poems were written. That's where the book came from.
Mm. And do you remember the moment when you recovered this memory, when you realized that you had been the victim of this abuse?
No, it was a series of memories that went on for 6 or 7 years. So I don't remember exactly, you know, the mm-hmm. first memory. I just remember they came very quickly for a number of years. And because they came in the form of multiple personalities, it was like my own family. I mean, there were a lot of entities to deal with. And I, you know, I loved them. And those are the ones who created a lot of the poetry. I mean, just the nature of the entities within you, I think they probably channeled me or I channeled them.
Mm.
This all sounds completely insane to anybody who's not acquainted with it, but I'll just go on blathering on and see how much people can understand.
Well, just to translate for a little bit, because you write at the beginning of the book that you were diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder, which used to be called multiple personality disorder, in response to your childhood abuse. So mm-hmm. you write in your author's note that you had many little authors, right, who wrote these poems. So right. many aspects of your personality. Did they have names? Did they have distinct personalities? Who are they?
Definitely distinct personalities. They could fight with each other. Some very young. Yasha is in the book. And he says, as he explains, he's a 12-year-old German boy whose parents survived the Holocaust. And so I take this little boy seriously, and they're explaining a lot of things to me through writing. And so his own writing explained about him as much as he understood, or as much as anybody could understood, because it's all in some ways a great mystery all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, specific personality. Some of them don't like each other. Sometimes I would have what amounted to group therapy. Again, it's really too crazy for most people to understand. But if there are people who are acquainted with this world, then it makes all the sense in the world.
And are the other personalities, are they still with you, Yasha and the others?
They are. A couple of them are present, you know, periodically, under control, but present.
Mm-hmm.
And the
mm-hmm.
others all took off to different places. If I really, really want to find something out from somebody, I can usually tap into them somewhere. But they're not present the way, you know, they were as I was finding them and as they were writing these little poems. They've all retired.
And did they help you when you were writing and performing music?
You know, I think that was a lot of that was before I discovered everybody. So you say Diamonds and Rust, for instance, was just if somebody was at play there, I didn't know.
I do want to talk about Diamonds and Rust, but first I want to play a version we have queued up. And this is the version you recorded with Judy Collins. So I just want okay. to play a little bit of that.
Now I see you standing with brown leaves falling all around and snow in your hair. Now you're smiling out the window of that crummy hotel over Washington Square. Our breath comes in white clouds, mingles and hangs in the air. Speaking strictly for me, we both could have died.
That's Diamonds and Rust. It is sung by my guest, and it features her friend, Judy Collins, fellow performer. And
I love that version of it, by the way.
You do?
Do you,
is that your favorite version?
Oh, I don't know if there's a favorite one, but I remember working on it and then just loving it when he played it back. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, it is really great. So you were friends, you are friends with Judy Collins. You have been for decades. Can mm-hmm. you talk about your friendship with her?
I don't know how strong it was for many years. But I know that I knew that if I ever called her, there would be laughter. And she went in a very different direction musically. Mm-hmm. She played very upscale clubs, but that didn't stop us, you know, laughing and crying together whenever we meet.
Do you have the book in front of you, the book of poetry?
I do.
Because I want you to read your poem that you called Judy. You've titled Judy. It's about her and you.
Yeah, it's called Judy. Backstage, well, actually, and I'll tell you this, that I don't know what the concert was, but it was mine and she came backstage.
Okay.
Backstage, we embraced. I buried my face in my hands. And the conversation we'd never had tumbled out. It was a long road, you said. Forgive me for never being there, I said. I buried my face in my hands. You buried your son in the ground.
Oh, wow. That's very, very powerful.
I sent it to her ahead of time to see if it was okay with her to print it. And mm-hmm. she wanted me to print it. She said, please, yeah.
She's talking about her son, Clark, who died by suicide.
Yeah.
And when you say, forgive me for never being there, what are you referring to?
I wasn't there enough in her life. If she might have needed me and I wasn't around and not aware, probably around the death of her son, that I could have been more present or more helpful.
Hmm. So that kind of goes back to the beginning of our conversation when you were saying that at the time when you were performing a lot, it was more comfortable for you to be in larger settings. And now you're devoting yourself to your friends. And so I'm wondering if it's difficult for you to do that, if it's a new thing for you.
Well, the nice thing is, and I'm sure it's because of the years I spent working on trying to become a whole human being, it's not so difficult now. I mean, people associate intimacy with romance. And in that sense, I do not have intimacy at the moment, but I do have it with friends with whom I'm closer than I ever was in the past, that I wasn't able to share as easily as I have been able to in more recent years, you know, coming from that hard work that I did.
Yeah. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with musician and activist Joan Baez about her new book of poetry. It's called When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance, which is a great title.
Nice, easy to remember, right?
It's just so evocative. It's just fantastic. It just raises so many images and questions, and it's just super intriguing. So, do you write a lot about your activism in here? I didn't really notice so much about your political activism in the poems.
Well, during those years, I was traveling and singing, etc. But these are really more personal poems that came, once again, we're talking about from parts of me that I didn't even know. And I think mm-hmm. those parts I didn't know then were not political. They were just kids.
Right.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I've thought about this too. Hey, there's, you know, people are going to expect more political activism, et cetera, out of me in a poetry book, and it simply isn't there. And I'm sure it comes from the years that I was writing it. These little entities in my life were appearing and taking up a lot of my time and energy and expressing themselves on paper as well.
Mm-hmm. And are you politically active these days?
Well, it depends on what you mean by that. I haven't been on the streets. You know, it's interesting. The other day I thought, oh, I really want to be on those campuses where the kids are, you know, want to see the plight in Gaza. Mm-hmm. See it correctly, divest from Israel. I mean, certainly I'm sympathetic with all that. And then I think, well, wait a minute, I can't do that. I'm not a student. I don't even know if I would be welcome. So I'm sort of itching to be there and knowing that at the moment, it's not where I need to be for a lot of reasons. Doesn't mean I don't want to. It doesn't mean that I wouldn't.
Why do you think you wouldn't be welcomed?
Well, it's their school. And I mm-hmm. think sometimes coming onto the campus when you when you're, quote, outside agitator, does more damage to them than good. I think with their ardent support of themselves as students and that it is their campus and that they have a right to be doing what they're doing on their campus, I think that probably needs to be respected.
It's so evocative of the 60s at this point, especially when you think of Columbia University and the role that Columbia played in anti-Vietnam protests. Yeah. Does it take you back seeing all this campus protesting?
Yeah, of course it does. And I think these kids are very brave to be doing what they're doing. I wish that they'd been trained in nonviolence because it means that you don't, that you accept the police and you accept them in a different way. You don't start screaming at them to defend yourselves. And all of that is totally understandable. And if they were organized, you know, as King would have organized them, you don't let the police get the better of you by you shouting at them. That's all I can say, you know, that if you can picture that, if you can deal with it. This beautiful picture, a photograph from the 60s somewhere, I don't think it was in the States, but a woman standing with a flower in front of the guy who's got his gun aimed at her and at them. And that picture is so powerful because she's saying, you know, this is life, this is beauty. You don't need to have that gun pointed at us and offering him a flower. And those cops were so disarmed. I mean, they just didn't know what to do in that situation. So some more of that, I'm sure, would be helpful on the campuses.
What do you think will come out of all of this? I mean, you are a veteran of the protesting movement, and you've seen the aftermath of it.
Yeah.
What do you think will happen, or what do you hope will happen?
Well, I think that it's not out of the question that if they stay their ground, that they will get at least some portion of what it is they're demanding. I mean, I'm all in favor of compromise. Gandhi said, there's nothing wrong with compromise as long as you don't compromise your soul. So if the students can find ways to speak, keep things open and get at least a portion of what it is they want. You get a portion, then you keep fighting for the next chunk and the next chunk. And first of all, they've already done, I mean, they've already awakened a whole portion of this society, which really wasn't paying any attention, except in the most superficial way. So in a way, their job is already partly done. And then now hopefully they can stay on it until they get more substantial gains. I mean, I can't remember exactly. I think it was divestment back then with Ronald Reagan. And we all thought it would never happen. And we just kept at it and at it and at it. And whatever it was we were asking for finally took place. I mean, there's a point where the authorities don't know what to do with this. So if you can keep loving your heart and keep the battle going, then you've already in some ways won a part of it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, and thank you for everything else too. Thank you for being you.
Well, thank you for having me in my rambling talk. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. That's Joan Baez. Her new book of poetry is called When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance.
How many dead men will it take to build a dike that will not break? How many children must we kill before we make the waves stand still?
lucky boys are even paid. Men die to build their pharaoh's tombs, and still the teeming wounds. How many men to conquer Mars? How many dead to reach the stars? Farewell, my wistful Sargon bride. I'm going out to stem the tide. Some say it's yellow, some say